Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and there's lots of things to be frustrated about, but I'm going to share my frustration. And now, people, this because it's been happening, and some people, they're getting more and more aggressive regarding what they call internet security. Now, when they call it internet security, it's really internet controls. And what's really ironic is Google came out years ago with these secure certificates. And everybody goes, wow, that's really good. That's really important. Now, these secure certificates, as far as I'm concerned, don't really establish any security. What it does is it establishes Google control. Now, many people, when they go to reclaimingtherepublic.org, you'll notice that it's not an HTTPS. It's an HTTP, which means that, oh, it'll tell you up there that this is non-secure. Well, some browsers will not let you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org. And that's due to the fact that it's not secure. No, that's not true. There is nothing, there's no ads, there's no scripts. It is just basic documentation and content. In other words, information right there in HTML. But, this is just terrible. We don't want to allow you to go there. This was the beginning. This next iteration that is coming down, that actually Microsoft is saying, we are not going to allow your system or our operating system to operate on a computer that is not secure, this TPM, this Trusted Platform Model, which is 2.0. The new version is 2.0. And, Windows runs just fine on TPM 1.0. What is it? And obviously, this isn't just, a cork. This is software that is written into a module that is actually allows a distant side. Okay, we recognize that you're secure. I believe there's back doors to this. And I believe that they have the ability. It's kind of like the OBD. And I kind of mentioned last Friday on Feedback Friday, and this is something that's just been bothering me. Corporations are moving forward because, how much money does a corporation really make? Now, let me get specific. How much money does a car manufacturer really make if they're allowing you to keep cars more and more? Now, you'd think the environmentalists would be all over this. Are you kidding me? You're going to create more and more and more instead of allowing us to preserve the ones that we have? Every car manufacturer out there sent the message out to the dealership that you better stop working on vehicles that are 2007 or older. Or in other words, I think the line is that they will work on a 2007 vehicle, and that's it. If it's 2006 or 5, they will not touch it. Now, why is that? Because if they make it hard, and all of a sudden, if there is an overflow of people going to these, other repairs, then they will make you feel or get to a point. They're squeezing you. So they're pushing you out to go find somebody else. And the reason why a lot of people use dealership, even though it is more expensive, they have deeper pockets. Now, I'm here to tell you that dealership started playing shenanigans where we had a dealership damage our car. And after we said, hey, you damaged our car, and I've got evidence to prove this, they said, well, we don't care. Take us to court. And I ended up talking to a lawyer, and the lawyer says, most lawyers aren't going to touch it because bottom line, it's only about a couple thousand dollars. So the lawyer told me that you know, go to a small claims court and get your money out of them, because small claims courts now, or at least where I live, are up to $10,000. And I said, okay, well, I guess what I should do is just, you know, cut my losses. And because the damage that they did in the repair actually damaged the engine. I've got a compression problem now because they've misdiagnosed it. They mistreated it for a couple of years. Anyway, I'm ranting. My point is this, folks, that you're going to be forced into buying new computers. You're going to be forced into buying new cars. You're going to be forced into the platforms that they have back doors to control you, to spy on you, and to use you. Now, I remember in the 90s, we were being told that that's what they were going to do. Well, they're doing it. And how many people have forgotten that over 30, 40 years ago, they were talking about, you know, this is what they're going to inevitably have to do to get this level of control over us. Because if too many people cling to their, you know, their old cars that they love, you know, like the old, you know, non-ethanol vehicles, as a matter of fact, they're going to make non-ethanol gas harder and harder to get. Why? Well, what happens to your vehicle? Let's say you have a bunch of vehicles and you fill them up with gas that's non-ethanol. Then that gas will actually last for a long time. And you don't have to drive it, nor do you stand a chance of damaging. Now, there, you know, it can get water, condensation, those types of things. But my point is, folks, that they're not doing this to make your product and make things better for us. They're doing things to force us. It's almost like the tobacco companies putting additives in to make you more addicted to smoke more product. This is how nefarious the corporations have gotten, and everyone is doing it. Does that make it right? No, it only proves the moral turpitude that is running crazy in America today. Now, forgive me for the rant, but I do want to get into what we've been focused on. And what we've been focused on is Madison's notes on the convention. Now, technically, I think I have probably a few more days, and then we're going to dive into the ratification debates, which will probably force me to do some basic content or what have you as a prelude into, because really, if you look at the series of how we're going through all of this, we started off with the Committees of Safety with the Toriacs at the beginning of the year. In other words, the beginning, the launching of the revolution, and then the establishment of the first government, so forth. And it's all a logical sequence, what we're doing. So once we go through the ratification debates, then we're going to go through a few years of violations and challenges with the Constitution in setting up the precedents. What we will try to do, because a lot of this stuff is just content. I believe that the best service I can give America, because your kids aren't getting this and you didn't get this, is giving you the facts, giving you the truth, reading these things so that they're accessible to you. I know that you're not going to go and actually pick up and read from the beginning to the end the ratification debates, just like nobody really reads the Federalist Papers anymore. And the Federalist Papers were just insightful. They're not legal terms and definitions to the Constitution like the ratification debates are. I want you to understand what I just said. When you hear people talk about the Constitution in an editorial version, and if they're not under oath, they're not, you know, selling the Constitution or the, you know, the anti-federalist, you know, trying to convince people otherwise in a forum that is actually ratifying, what they're doing is they're basically taking these editorials to the newspapers to basically put out these general ideas and insights. when you get into the ratification debates, there are challenges because the men in that room are saying, you know, why do we need to ratify this? And the Federalists go through, well, this will do this. And then the Anti-Federalists come along and they create these arguments that are straw man arguments, red herrings or what have you, to try to get the people to reject the Constitution. The question is, was the Constitution that much superior to the Articles of Confederation? The answer is clearly and a resounding yes. So when we go through and they actually, the hyperbole that came from the Anti-Federalists in claiming that this thing was the destruction of all society, as the Federalists went through and provided the clarity, those actually became, because this was a part of the adoption of the contract for each of the states to join into this compact, they were all basically going through and stipulating what each line meant. And in contract law, that is a legal definition. And I am here to tell you that only those definitions, if the definitions were created in the ratification debates, and remember, remember, ignorance of the law is no excuse. If so, it can be in any country. Ignorance of the law is no excuse in any country, because if so, then it can be pretended upon. Now, we have judges that are completely ignorant of the law. When I say they're ignorant of the law, they're ignorant of how these men clarified and defined and set the terms for each of these clauses. So when a judge reads that and they go, well, I'm ignorant of the definition, so I'm going to interpret instead. And they pretend. Ah, now do you get this? Now do you start to see why the academics deliberately obviated the ratification debates? Now you actually see how we have become so perverted in redefining the Constitution that they actually created the annotated Constitution so they could document and keep track so that they didn't have a couple of contending stories. Oh, no, we're on this story now. We're on this version. No, they kind of centralized it into this living Constitution, and it is all unconstitutional. And yet the judges are all embracing and praising this because it has fully aggrandized their power and dominance over we the people and our law, the law that we established. And I'm telling you, folks, there is no law that is grander. There's no law that secures a man and woman's liberty like our Constitution. The way they've perverted it is why people have problems. The things that they're doing without authority is why people have problems. So that, in essence, is why this is so important. And so when Madison starts covering these things, this is one of the reasons why many of the common agreed upon points, even though some of these men didn't necessarily agree, because we'll hear their arguments. When we go into the ratification debates, we'll go, oh, well, you know, Mr. Sherman kind of spoke out. Well, actually, Mr. Sherman didn't even contend the ratification debates. I mean, it was a slam dunk in Connecticut. They just went along with it. They didn't seriously debate it. So in the states where it was debated, like Virginia, we will actually see how Mr. Randolph and Mr. Mason and Madison and these other men, how they took positions in the ratification debates. And actually, some of the men in the ratification debates, or actually I should say, some of the men in Virginia, such as James McClurg and George Wythe, I think Wythe actually speaks up. He's an Anti-Federalist. But he doesn't speak. He's not a dominating force like Patrick Henry as the Anti-Federalist, who is using hyperbole. You know, like I said, it was just the call of heaven was going to come down and destroy the earth because of this Constitution. That's how dramatic and the level of hyperbolic speech that Patrick Henry was using during the ratification debates. So the question is, I know there's lots of people that admire Patrick Henry. They admire him as, you know, that horse, you know, give me liberty or give me death. You know, that strong, sturdy leader that, you know, came out during the revolution. But I'm here to tell you that he became corrupted by the cabal and actually refused this Constitution. And then, once it was ratified, he worked ardently to actually try to depose it. And he was driving, one of the drives he had was to actually call for a convention in the very first year. It was Virginia and New York that actually called for a convention so that they could undo the Constitution. And so, you know, they, because of that, because of Patrick Henry and Governor Clinton's efforts in the early days of the first session of government in May, because they did that, well, that actually helped galvanize Madison's interest and his, I'll say, his calling, because that became a calling for his very first year, was to draft and present a Bill of Rights. Even though he argued against it, he felt that the people needed and wanted this, and so he became the champion of it. He became the champion of the people. And because they got the Bill of Rights, no state stood up the next year to say, we do believe we need to have this Article 5 convention. And it silenced them, you know, Henry, and it silenced Clinton as well. I mean, this concept of trying to undo what they did was basically becoming a bad thought. But what ended up happening was Hamilton actually started attacking the Constitution in the subsequent years. And I believe that's when Henry and the rest of these cabal said, hey, you know, let's move our cabal to the federal government and let's get bigger pockets and let's become stronger and more powerful. And that actually, they succeeded, and they grew and grew until they got greedy with the 1798. But we'll get into all of that. I'll lay that all out in the upcoming, you know, the shows when we go past the ratification debates. But the militia, this is August 23rd, and we're talking about very specifically, let me see here, who is it that starts talking? Well, it doesn't really say. It says, in convention, the report of the Committee of 11 made August 21st being taken up, and the following clause being under consideration, to wit, quote, to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the U.S., reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed. Tack, close quote. Mr. Sherman moved to strike out the last member, quote, authority of training, etc. He thought it unnecessary. The states will have this authority, of course, if not given up. Mr. Ellsworth doubted the propriety of striking out the sentence. The reason assigned applies as well as to the other reservations of the appointment to offices. He remarked at the same time that the term discipline was of a vast extent and might be so expounded as to include all power on the subject. Ah. And so this is how, in other words, Mr. Ellsworth is pointing out how this is going to be perverted, just like Mason did. By way of explanation, Mr. King said that by organizing the committee meant proportioning the officers and men by arming, specifying the kind of size, caliber of arms, by disciplining, prescribing the manual exercises, evolutions, and etc. So right there, you actually have a hard definition of what that meant. Mr. Sherman withdrew his motion. In other words, Mr. Sherman basically said, oh, well, since you stated it that way, okay, that makes sense. Mr. Gary basically stated the power in the United States, as explained, is making the states drill sergeants. He had, as Leaf, let the citizens of Massachusetts be disarmed as to take the command for the states and subject them to the general legislature, it would be regarded as a system of despotism. Mr. Madison observed that, quote, arming, as explained, did not extend to furnishing arms, nor the term disciplining and to penalties and court-martials for enforcing them. Now, as we actually read the Constitution today, when they talk about arming, that actually means that they are required to help provide that support. What they do today is, instead of arming the militia, they're militarizing your mercenary forces and your city police forces. These mercenaries that aren't a part of the citizenry. In other words, they're not held to the standards of a militia. In other words, they've allowed themselves to go and actually aggrandize. Because what ends up happening when you create a mercenary force? You create a municipal police force. Instead of using your sheriff and militia, what happens is that police force starts contending, hey, we would be safer if we disarmed the public. Then only we can enforce the law and only we can defend your life. That right there is the inevitable, and that's how we've gotten into this whole mess, because we've been using these types of mechanisms, or I should say, because we've been using mercenary enforcement. Mr. Madison observed that, okay, we actually just did that. Mr. King added to his former explanation that army meant not only to provide for the uniform of arms, but included the authority to regulate the modes of furnishing, either by the militia themselves, the state governments, or the national treasury. Now, that laws for disciplining must involve penalties and everything necessary for enforcing penalties. So, again, Mr. King actually spells it out again. The authority to regulate modes of furnishing either by the militia, the state governments, and or the national treasury. So in other words, Mr. Madison, you know, was contrary. Now, as you go through this and as you understand what he did, what Madison did in drafting this overall plan and being the architect of the Constitution. Never do I see him standing up and having a fit and actually acting like he's defending his baby. 9 times out of 10, when people write something, when people actually create something, they take pride in authorship. It's almost like being a parent. And they start defending it. And 9 times out of 10, a good idea, a good book, or what have you, which could have been better, actually never evolves, never gets better, because the parent constantly defends their, you know, their creature. Mr. Dayton moved to postpone the paragraph in order to take up the following proposition. Quote, to establish an uniform and general system of discipline for militia of these states and to make laws for organizing, arming, disciplining, and governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving the states respectively the appointment of officers and all authority over the militia not herein given to the general government. On the question to postpone in favor of this proposition, it passed in the negative. In other words, many people just said no. So Mr. Dayton went away with his feelings hurt, possibly, because they rejected it. Now, Mr. Ellsworth and Mr. Sherman moved and postponed the second clause in favor of the following. To establish a uniformity of arms, actually, we'll come back with this because I didn't realize we're going to go into break. Of course, I spent all this time ranting early on. So we'll come back and dive into Mr. Ellsworth and Mr. Sherman's points right after this promo. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Mr. Ellsworth and Mr. Sherman moved to postpone the second clause in favor of the following: to establish an uniformity of arms, exercise and organize the militia, and to provide for the government of them when called into service of the United States. So in other words, to establish a uniformity of arms. In other words, they weren't going to provide them with arms for the national security. The federal government was not going to give them arms for everybody to be safe. In other words, that was the one thing that they were actually, the federal government was supposed to do, the general government was supposed to do. And so let me get back to the objection of this proposition was to refer the plan for the militia to the general government, but leave the execution of it to the states. In other words, leave it all to the states. The bad actors, those institutions that had proven, you know, to actually not regard their citizens. Anyway, Mr. Langdon said he could not understand the jealousy expressed by some gentlemen. The general and state governments were not enemies to each other, but different institutions for the good of the people of America. As one of the people, he could say, the national government is mine. The state government is mine. In transferring power from one to the other, I only take out of my left hand what I shall not use so well and put it in my right hand where it can be used better, where it can be better used. It's an interesting analogy. Mr. Gary thought it was rather taking out the right hand and putting it into the left. Will any man say that liberty will be as safe in the hands of 80 or 100 men taken from the whole continent as in the hands of 200 or 300 taken from a single state? Mr. Dayton was against so absolute a uniformity. In some states, there ought to be a greater proportion of cavalry than others. In some places, rifles would be more proper. In others, muskets and etc. General Pinckney preferred the clause reported by the committee extending the meaning of it to the case of fines and etc. Mr. Madison basically states this: the primary object is to secure an effectual discipline of the militia. This will no longer be done if left to the states separately than the requisitions have been hitherto paid by them. In other words, he just slapped him in the face saying, we can't trust the states because they're not even paying the taxes they're supposed to pay. The states neglect their militia now, and the more they are consolidated in one nation, the less each will rely on its own interior provisions for its safety, and the less prepare its militia for that purpose, in like manner as the militia of a state. Like a militia of a state would have been more neglected than it had been if each county had been independently charged with the care of its militia. There you have it right there. What did he just say? I'm going to go to the last part here. Let me back up to where the beginning of the sentence is. It's a long sentence. The states neglect their militia now, and the more are consolidating into one nation, the less each will rely on its own interior provisions and safety, and the less prepare its mission for that purpose. Semicolon. In like manner, as the militia of a state would have been still more neglected than it had been if each county had been independently charged with the care of its militia. Now, let me go back to why counties matter most. As we talk about, what is the exit criteria for a county? A county should have a requisite or a portion militia that actually meets its needs. When we go into the creation of new states, who creates that? Each county should actually demand in their own constitutions that a militia be formed and maintained for the security as well as for the execution of the laws, as well as to suppress insurrections, as well as to repel invasions. And in so doing, when every county acknowledges the necessity of having its own militia as a part of the sheriff and the sheriff's entity, that, and as a matter of fact, I would even go as far as to say no mercenary forces will be employed in this county. Mercenary mean professional, where that becomes their job, and they come and work for 20 years, and they obtain a retirement. It is a citizen's duty to support the laws of the land and to enforce them. A citizen's duty. And so if we actually started going down this path, then how much crime would really be committed, because everybody would be far more abreast with what the real crimes and how, you know, the enforcement of crime, and everybody would be responsible, because there would be a greater crime if you were to enforce the crime and you did nothing. In other words, in some ways, as a matter of fact, in the military, they had, I forget what it was called, where they were runners. These guys that would actually go, let's say somebody would, help me out here, somebody would go AWOL, they would leave the service, they would abandon their uniform and everything, and they would go AWOL. And so, or they would commit a crime and go AWOL. And so there's like a bench warrant for everybody. So that's why many people in Vietnam that went AWOL went to Canada to stay away from being able to be, you know, taken back by these runners. So these runners were like escorts. They would come to the local police and they would carry them back to where they would stand trial. Now, once the runners obtained control of the runaway, the AWOL person, then they would actually have the greater crime. In other words, if that runner got away from them, then they would face the trial that that runner would face, and they would be basically, you know, that runner would still be punished. They would still, you know, call out to get that guy. But those people that were actually escorting would be held accountable, you know, and basically be tried and found guilty of the same crime. And so the incentive is, folks, that if you don't stop the crime, then you will be considered aiding and abetting and actually suffer the consequences of the same. And when we look at a society that understands its symbiotic relationship, its mutual benefits of maintaining law and order, we, especially if it is good law, that's the whole point. If we are all participating, bad laws will go away. Like the confiscation of property from, you know, somebody because they didn't pay their taxes. I'm telling you, you know, you would have a hard time getting, you know, the young men in your neighborhood to go and seize the property of elderly people that can't afford taxation on their property. Because they're not making money. They're incapable of being productive and making that kind of money, because taxation on property is just getting out of hand. And I'm here to tell you that that law and the way we tax property would go away. We would commute that tax to something different. Period. As a matter of fact, here's the thing. We have way too much taxes because we have way too much unconstitutional government. When government is doing things it has no authority to do, then it has to tax you to do those things. We don't have a tax problem. We have a spending problem, just to be clear on this. Anyway, so let me get back to this. Again, this is Mr. Madison. He said, "In light," I just want to repeat this one more time. "In like manner as the militia of a state would have been still more neglected than it has been if each county had been independently charged with the care of its militia." And there you go, folks. I'm actually making a note of this. When you look at this, you'll actually see this so you can find it, because it will actually be a part of the heading. So you'll actually see Mr. Madison, county and militia right there. Now, when we get into the ratification debates, they actually talk about this, that the militia should be, and I think that this may be a stipulation, but because it was a stipulation in the Virginia ratification debates, that as they laid out the design and the employment of the militia out to the counties and the apportionment thereof, that this was to be applied to every state. So, because you can't have things happening, when you have a union where everybody's going to abide by, then as they've provided better clarity in formulas and explaining what that clause really means, then that gets applied to all of the states. Just because none of the states other than Massachusetts came up with this clarity that Congress cannot pass a law and immune themselves from the same oppression. In other words, they can't create a tax and then, exempt themselves from having to pay it. And so because that was stipulated in Massachusetts, that's applied to Congress, period, not just the Massachusetts congressman. Folks, when you take a view of the ratification debates with that light, you will find that we'll have a far better framed government as these men had these epiphanies in different states to say, this is how this is to be. And we'll act because there's a reason why these things came up. And there's no doubt in my mind, the divine hand of providence was definitely active in these ratification debates, which is why the Constitution was unanimously ratified. Even though it was close, and even though North Carolina suspended its ratification, that doesn't mean that they weren't partakers of this beautiful document. They were. They ended up coming in, and there's no doubt in my mind, they could have benefited by being active and involved in the very first session. Anyway, Madison concludes with this. "The discipline of the militia is evidently a national concern and ought to be provided in the national constitution." There you go. Now, Mr. Martin basically said, and he's an anti-federalist, and where's Mr. Martin from? Mr. Martin is from North Carolina, was confident that the states would never give up the power over the militia, and that if they were to do so, the militia would be less attended to by the general government than by the state governments. And that's absolutely not true. Both governments deliberately unattended to the militia, which is why after the War of 1812, when we started recognizing peace, the militia was completely ignored, and the federal government created the cavalry to basically, go after and protect the Western expanse and actually create the Indian Wars and so forth, instead of trying to actually, because remember, they had an opportunity in 1803, before the cavalry and the establishment of this expanse west, they had the opportunity to amend the Constitution so that they could grant permanent land to the Indians, and they refused to do that. They refused to do that. So, Mr. Randolph now pipes up and says, "What danger could there be that the militia could be brought into the field and made to commit suicide on themselves? This is a power that cannot, from its nature, be abused, unless indeed the whole mass should be corrupted. He was for trammeling the general government whenever there was a danger, but here there could be none. He urged that this is an essential point, observing the militia, where everywhere neglected by the state legislatures, the members of which courted popularity too much to enforce a proper discipline, leaving the apportionment of officers to the states, protects the people against every apprehension that could produce murmur. Now, this trammeling, what is there? There's no synonym for that. So I'm sorry. I don't know what that means, and I'm not going to take the time because I don't have Paul reading this, so I could look it up. So anyway, Mishapal. On the question of Mr. Ellsworth's motion, and I forget what Mr. Ellsworth's motion was, all the way up here, moved to postpone the second clause in favor for, you know, this completely new paragraph. So on the motion, New Hampshire said no, Massachusetts no, Connecticut yes, New Jersey no, Pennsylvania no, Delaware no, Maryland no, Virginia no, everybody else said no. So hold on here. There was only one yes, and it was Mr. Ellsworth's group, Connecticut. So, in other words, the motion failed. And a motion was made to recommit the second clause, which was negatived, on the question to agree to the first part of the clause, namely, to make laws for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed of the United States. Yay, or New Hampshire said yes, Massachusetts yes, Connecticut said no, Connecticut, the one that wanted the other one, New Jersey yes, Pennsylvania yes, Delaware yes, Maryland no, Virginia yes, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia yes. So in other words, it was 9-2. Now, one of the things you're going to notice as we move and we progress, we're going to actually find Hamilton now starts getting involved in the very end. I think it's in September. He finally comes back and, you know, starts piping up. Anyway, Mr. Madison moved to amend the next part of the clause to read as, quote, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers under the rank of general officers. Mr. Sherman considered this as absolutely inadmissible. He said that if the people should be so far asleep as to allow the most influential officers of the militia to be appointed by the general government, every man of discernment would arouse them by sounding alarm to them. Now, let me just take a break here. When we look at the fact that we actually have officers that are in the regular army that are, so just to be clear, a regular army is unconstitutional. The only army that can be formed is the federalization of the militia. The federal government, the Constitution clearly dictates that that's the they shall have the power to call forth the militia to do these things, not to just be peacekeeping forces. That's not in the Constitution. So to be clear again, the federal government had no ability, and now when we look at how many officers, you've heard me say this, you know, the officers in the military are politicians. I don't trust them. You really have to prove to me that you are a true advocate of liberty before I say, you know, that that officer is possibly a good man, because they sell themselves and prostitute themselves for political agendas, and they're willing to do, I'll just say, really evil things. I have actually seen officers say that I will willingly let all of my men die just for the better good, instead of actually coming up with a really good salient plan. Now, fortunately, the forces or the people that were in that meeting, this was for the very first Gulf War, for the very first Gulf War. I don't want to say what organization it was, but it was in the Marine Corps. But what organization within the Marine Corps? But this colonel basically says, and he was doing this so he could probably buck for general. those people that do those types of things at the expense of others, that is truly evil. And so I am resolved, you know, I may meet you and I may give you the due respect as an officer, but I'm looking and judging you to make sure that you are a leader of men, not a politician. Because if you're a politician, then you are actually the antithesis of a leader of men. Because when we really look at the officer training and the officer, you know, the way they, you know, utilize, because you can actually see how good officers really do break rank from the politics. They actually stand up and do the right thing. And so anyway, I will stop myself there. Mr. Gary, let us once destroy the state governments, have an executive for life on hereditary and proper Senate, and then there would be some consistency of giving full power to the general government. But as the states are not to be abolished, he wondered at the attempts that were made to given inconsistent with their plan of vigorous government at every risk. Others are more democratic, cast will opposite it in equal determination, and a civil war may be produced by the conflict. Now, it's interesting that he's talking like this, but to be clear, the Anglophiles, who were the states that were Anglophiles that actually leaned to and felt having a noble monarch was far better than just having a temporary replaceable president? Madison was not an Anglophile. As a matter of fact, he was kind of, you know, an American. He really looked at foreigners and foreign influence as not good. Jefferson was a Francophile. Madison kind of, I think, maybe bit his tongue regarding Jefferson's affinity for the French. Now, the Francophiles, you know, were pretty much, you know, down to the south. The Anglophiles were the north, and Hamilton was in the north. And Hamilton, remember, he already talked about injecting that type of plan. Anyway, Mr. Madison, as of the great danger, again, as of the great danger of disunion of the states, it is necessary to guard against it by sufficient powers to the common government, and as the greatest danger to liberty is from large standing armies, it is best to prevent them by an effectual provision for a good militia. He basically just stated what I had just reaffirmed, that the fact that we have a standing army, we have a standing air force, you know, the only force in the Navy that is to be our external security is the Navy. Now, I think I said that twice, and I think I misstated. The only thing in the Constitution that actually allows for an external guarding force is the Navy. The intent of the militia and the Army and the home defenses was to be in the Army, which is why the National Air Guard, or the Air Guard, was a part of the Army when it was formed. And then they expanded its role, and all of a sudden, all of these things started competing for international prominence. And I'm here to tell you, folks, the Constitution's clear. That was only the design was the Navy would have that full control. But, oh, you know what? If we create more services that can do this, then we'll have more officer opportunities for people, for people to become the ranks of officers and, you know, and command all of this respect. Anyway. Yeah, and, you know, to be honest now, let me just lay this out here, that when you really look at officers in those days, they were educated. The enlisted was very illiterate. A lot of them just wrote an X or what have you. They were, you know, it's not that they couldn't do things. It's just that they were illiterate. They weren't formally educated. Now, some men could actually sign and some men were educated, but there was a huge abyss between the elite and or the officer corps and the enlisted corps. There was a big abyss. Today, when we have high school graduates in the enlisted force that are working on the technical complexities of the avionics and making airplanes fly and making them work, patching them together to get that plane up in the air, I'm telling you that when your enlisted is able to do those types of things and you're just sending the officers out to pull the trigger, you know, who actually has the greater education? It's that formal degree now, and this absolutely started separating the Ivy schools, or I should say the Ivy Tower, from the real smart and well-educated people to actually understand the complexities of this weaponry and so forth. And that's why, you know, we should actually completely dismantle the officers and the enlisted, because the whole point of having these separations was because there was a vast abyss between these two elements of society. In other words, we had a very good education system until now. Now they're actually proving and they're creating this abyss. And actually the problem is everybody that's involved in the education system is, in other words, we're probably better off putting the military in charge with those guys that never went to school than we are with those people that have gone to school, because the education is so, I'll just say, so contrary to what we really need out of our forces. Anyway, let me get back to this. So now they actually have a question to solve. On the question to agree to Mr. Madison's motion, New Hampshire said yes. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. In other words, everybody but South Carolina, Georgia, and New Hampshire all said yes. On the question to agree to reserving the states the appointment of officers, it was agreed without contest. On the question on the clause and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by the United States, it looked like everybody but Delaware and Virginia and South Carolina and Georgia. So there were four states that said no, so it passed, it carried. And so we've got less than a minute. I'm going to basically take this at this point. Mr. Pinckney is up. They're still going through this militia, and they're going to get into treaties and so forth. So we're going to continue when we come back tomorrow, because I've got just less than a minute. There's no point in trying to push the rock further down the road. And so, folks, I want you to start to understand that, you know, as they were talking about this, even though they didn't agree as they initially debated this, they moved the ball, and whether they, you know, there was, just because there were people that were complaining about it didn't mean it was carried. In other words, there had been cases, we saw this, where there was constant complaint about, you know, the slave trade being stopped, and actually it passed overwhelmingly. So just be clear here. There's a lot of times where you'll see a lot of negativity in the debate, but how did the motion carry? Did it actually pass? And if it did by an overwhelming number, then that speaks contrary to what you would think because you're watching the comments on the sheet. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.